For the second of today's underreported segments, we look into the growing popularity of Islamic financial practices, that's banking and investing based on the Quran, and how it's faring in the current global economic crisis. With me now is Carla Power, author of an article called Faith in the Market in the January-February foreign policy issue of Foreign Policy Magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Can you explain the rules of Islamic finance?
Well, the basic and sort of most famous rule that gets bandied about is that Islamic finance doesn't allow interest. And it also generally doesn't allow people to invest in the banking sector or in the entertainment sector. And it doesn't allow people to invest in what are considered ethically questionable questionable businesses like pork production, alcohol production, gambling, or pornography.
Trade is okay as long as equal amounts of money are traded and risks must be shared.
Yes. That trade is okay as long as there are underlying assets. It's very much there's an early hadith, actually, a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, which says that basically you are not allowed to purchase an unborn animal in its mother's womb, or the sale of milk in the udder without measurement, or the purchase of spoils of war prior to their distribution. So, in other words, this is read as a sort of curb on uncertainty in contracts. You really have to be sure of what you're getting. So a lot of the speculation we've seen recently in the market would be banned by Islamic finance.
What about the whole matter of financial risks? How does Islamic finance deal with that?
Well, yeah, gambling is banned. And so, yes, you are not allowed to take undue risks. It's interesting. You look at the Dow Jones Islamic Market Index, which was started in the late 90s as a way to sort of vet Islamically correct stocks that Islamic investors could invest in, and it has a benchmark of only you can only have a 33% debt to market capitalization. You cannot go into debt more than 33%, or you immediately get struck off the list. And so that kind of risk prevention served it well, actually. 6 months before WorldCom sort of collapsed in 2002, the Dow Jones Islamic Market Index delisted it for exceeding the acceptable debt ratio. Alarm bells went off, and it was struck off. And it also ejected Tyco and Enron on similar grounds.
How does this apply on a more personal level? If I go to a bank that practices this approach and I want to get a car loan or a credit card or insurance, what happens? Is it similar to what would happen in a bank in New York?
Yeah, well, actually, there are many banks in New York that I think could help you out. There has by now, sort of after 25 years or so, there's been a fairly parallel system, so that almost any financial product you could hanker after, you could find one that is the Islamic equivalent. So say you go to a bank, say you want to buy a house or a car, you'd go to, you could go to HSBC Amana, you could go to Citibank, you could go to Deutsche Bank, and or the scores of, other banking services, and you could get a mortgage based on something called murabaha, in which the bank buys it. The bank buys your house or your car, and then you have an agreement whereby the bank is going to sell it back to you gradually, and with you paying fixed installments over time. And, of course, the bank takes a little bit of a little bit or a lot, depending on what its rates are, of a markup. Or you could get a house or a car based on the concept of ijara, or a lease, in which, again, the bank buys the car or your house or your yacht or whatever and then leases it out to you. And when the lease period ends and you've paid it back, ownership is transferred. I mean, the central idea is actually that the depositors or the financiers have a more central role in risk sharing. So at the very heart, I mean, it was funny, before I started this article, I thought, oh, you know, yes, Islam bans interest. And it was a sort of, when I thought about it cursorily, it was this sort of, you know, step on a crack and break your mother's back rule. But at the sort of moral core of this is the goal of social justice, that a financier or the bank or the lender must share an investment's risk with the person who's borrowing. And so it's trying to make financial transactions less like Western-style loans and more like partnerships between the lender and the borrower.
So there'd be no short selling of stocks or buying and selling debt?
No, there wouldn't. You can't repackage and trade debt. You can't do credit default swaps. All of this is so central to the financial crisis. You can't short sell stocks on the grounds that you can't sell what you don't own. And so that is one of the arguments behind proponents of Islamic finance, saying that, you know, if we had followed the Sharia or the interpretations of Islamic laws to the letter, this financial crisis could have been avoided.
Well, do wealthy people who are Muslims actually practice this? For example, I know there are a fair number of people who've invested in Western banks, and probably many of the financial institutions that are in trouble these days have some money from millionaires from Saudi Arabia or Dubai and the like. Is this something that's practiced within the Muslim countries, but doesn't necessarily apply to outside those countries?
It's vastly growing in popularity. I mean, I think it's 40 years ago it didn't really exist. If you were a very strict Muslim millionaire, you'd keep your money under your mattress, or be sure to invest in something like real estate or real assets that you could touch, or gold or silver. But increasingly, it depends on your, you know, how comfortable you feel with it. But increasingly, there are signs that more and more Muslims, given the choice, would like to opt for Islamic financial products. I mean, I think Standard & Poor estimates that in Asia and the Gulf, 20% of banking customers would opt for Islamic financial products over regular ones, given the opportunity. And there's an estimate that is sort of by 2012, nearly a third of all business deals in the Gulf will be done through Islamic finance. And indeed, it's spreading beyond just Muslims. There are some funds that say that sort of 60% of their customers, I think Saturna Capital, a Washington-based investment firm, says that 60% of its customers for its Sharia-compliant mutual funds weren't Muslim. And half of all HSBC's Islamic mortgages in Malaysia went to non-Muslims just because the terms and conditions were attractive to people at large.
I'm talking to Carla Power, whose article, Faith in the Market, is in the January-February issue of Foreign Policy magazine. So there's no repackaging and trading debt, no short-selling stocks, no risky mortgages, It sounds like, at least in theory, that the current financial crisis couldn't have happened under Islamic law. Has it played out that way in Muslim financial centers? Have they been totally immune to this current financial crisis?
No, alas. No, it is because, and you know, you'll talk to even the most excited and optimistic proponent of Islamic law, and they'll say, look, we're not in a purely Islamic system. And indeed, some, you know, it, even if you are vetting your Islamic finances by stringent benchmarks, you know, we're not going to invest in banks, we're not going to invest in pork or alcohol, the money has to come from somewhere. And right now, the Western style of banking is pretty much the global style of banking. So, no. That said, there have been signs that they've done slightly better. Late in December, came news that the returns for the Amana Trust Income Fund, which is the main Muslim investment fund in the U.S., had lost only slightly over a quarter of its value, which which sounds bad, but of course it's a relative bonanza next to the average 44% loss for American stock funds. You know, analysts said that part of the reason was because the fund didn't invest in financial stocks. So you're somewhat trotted, but no, somewhere down the line, if you're dealing in a global system, you're going to get money that's tainted or related to the rest of the market.
What about the other side of this story? That many people right now are suspicious of anything Islamic. I understand that a Michigan bank that branched out into Islamic finance saw some customers close their accounts when they found out that they were getting into Islamic banking. Some of the employees quit, and they were unhappy that the bank stopped having a Christmas party and allowed people to drink alcohol at work events.
They meaning the Islamic...
The employees who were used to the American way and saw this as a foreign imposition on American culture. There are a lot of people, there's a certain amount of anger toward anything Islamic these days in this country.
Yeah, well, I think that's extremely unfortunate. First of all, what is Islamic, I think, since 9/11 has been twisted and sort of hijacked by notions of linking it to all sorts of things that are entirely unrelated to Islam. So it's a pity that that customers took their money out of the bank when of course, as we all know, it needed most if this happened in recent times. I think, though, when you look at the growing acceptance of Islamic finance in the markets, I mean, you see absolutely, you know, I live in London, and, you know, there's a European Islamic investment bank now staffed by, you know, very, very proper city bankers, very proper London financial district bankers. And, you know, places like Deutsche Bank and HSBC and Citibank are tripping over themselves to open up Islamic windows or services.
But those are banks that were burned in the previous economic climate, so perhaps they're looking for ways to avoid similar problems in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, and certainly before oil prices took a tumble, it just made economic sense to go where the customers and the money was.
Now, Carla, who monitors Islamic finance? Who decides what's halal and haram?
Well, it's a controversial area. There are a couple of monitoring organizations, one based in Bahrain, that is probably the most central monitoring organization. But it's the AAOIFI. But it is it's a regulatory institution that sets standards. The controversial aspect of this is that there are a very, very small number of scholars who can understand both English language, intricate financial contracts, and the medieval jurisprudence that forms the cornerstone of Islamic science.
So does this require collaboration between Islamic scholars and bankers?
Absolutely. All the time. If you want to start an Islamic bank or an Islamic window or even offer an Islamic product, what you're going to need is a Sharia board. And a Sharia board is a group of scholars who can vet your financial products to make sure that they pass muster, religiously speaking. There are relatively few scholars. There are about 20, I would say, that are, as one wag put it, the rock star scholars, who are some of the busiest men I've ever tried to track down in years and years of reporting. They are moving targets because they are so in demand. To be able to have the you know, intricate grounding in the Islamic sciences, to have, you know, really top-level madrasa education, as well as a grounding in modern finance, is, you know, makes you a very rare commodity.
But as I understand Islamic practice, it can vary from place to place. The local imam can interpret Sharia differently in Nigeria than somebody else does in Indonesia.
Absolutely.
And that could lead to really complicated banking practices, couldn't it?
Of course. That's absolutely true. And there are splits, and there have been in the past splits between Malaysia, which has been a real it's been a pioneer in Islamic finance and has set up an intricate infrastructure, and the Gulf states, which tend to be more conservative in terms of what they will okay and what they will agree is halal or permissible. But increasingly, I mean, and they say this, you know, they say we've got to get global standards because right now it's really slowing us down to have to debate. But there is a convergence of opinion increasingly as the industry gets more developed.
Well, in the past, of course, there's been Islamic banking for 1,500 years or so. The big difference is it was always done on a small level, and now suddenly it's a major international concern?
Yeah. I wouldn't say that there was modern Islamic. There were certainly practices and modes of contracts and economic theory that had been developed since the time of the Prophet. But modern Islamic finance really started in the 1960s and sort of came out of a post-colonial notion of, you know, we need something to call our own. Let's shuck off the West and draw on our own culture and our own traditions and our own values. So it started in Egypt in the late 60s, early 70s, as a way, you know, banks started giving loans to students and giving loans to poor people. And it's mushroomed into, you know, Islamic hedge funds and Islamic mutual funds and so on.
And we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Carla Power is the author of an article called Faith in the Market. It is in the January-February issue of Foreign Policy magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.